Welcome to Webcology. Webcology is the show that takes you into the deepest and darkest ends of the ecosystem on the internet. Our guides will take you on a journey into web marketing and bring you the experts and the information so that you can further explore the web marketing world. Now, here are the hosts of Webcology, Jim Hedger and Dave Davies.
Hey everyone, welcome to Webcology on WMR.fm. It's halfway through June 2022. It's June the 16th, 2022. This is Jim Hedger from Digital Always Media and Dave Davies from Weights and Biases. It's been a truly, truly interesting week on a number of different fronts. But, you know, it's been most interesting week on the AI front. There's been great controversy around AI. There's been great creativity around and behind AI. I've seen some like wonderful AI inspired art this week, and we've all seen the nightmare fuel created by DALL-E this week. It's been interesting, but of all the stories, Dave, and the one that I thought would interest you most, my mistake, by the way, we'll get into the one that interested you most in a few moments, but was the Google researcher, Blake Lemoine, who was put on sudden temporary leave for publicly suggesting that a piece of AI that Google, a piece of AI, AI model that Google had written called Lambda had become sentient.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2022. First question, is this like and Dave, you're the guy to ask of all the contacts in the Webcology world right now. You're the closest guy. Is this possible? Can there be a sentient AI 2022?
Yeah, I don't think so. I tend to go with And this has got to be like, how do you define certain things? And certain things are, difficult. But a well trained model, which is what we have here, right? Like it's incredible. This is what it was trained to do, was communicate effectively, right? Like we've talked about Lambda in the past, right? Like it came out, months ago. Like they sort of announced that it was coming in. Clearly, he's working on it. This is sort of what it's built to do. Is gather information from multiple sources and then create a more conversational, ability. So I understand, like we as human beings really, really like to sort of like identify with other things and see in them. So like, think about pets, right? Like we all put that like human, it must love me. Nope, it's a cat, right? Like I'm sure it loves you as a food source, but it will watch you as it grabs something you know it knows you love and pushes it off the table. it's a very different thing.
Humans, I love, do stuff like that to me all the time. Well, that's
true. So I think this is just a case of personifying, seeing something that didn't exist. We're not there yet.
But you know the conversation he uses as evidence. You must have read the transcript of this. It was a long conversation, an in-depth conversation, one that I think any of us would have been quite interested in, especially if it was like late night at a bar, talking life, death, the meaning of sentience itself. The program expressed what appeared to be a legitimate fear at the idea of being like, shut off. It seemed to be aware of what it was.
Well, indeed. And this becomes it appeared to be aware, right? And this becomes the really, really blurry line that we are approaching, because do I think that at some point in the future, we will cross that line? Like that line in the sand where all of a sudden we need to acknowledge, like sort of go, okay, something has happened, and we all sort of consciously or subconsciously, I guess we can, because we're human, sort of consciously go, oh, okay, it's now met this different, it's crossed over this line. It is now self-aware in a way that isn't just mimicking self-awareness, which is what, in my opinion, we're seeing here, but actually crossing over into being self-aware with a desire for autonomy, right? Which is also one of the other requirements, right? Like that I would say, like an understanding of what autonomy means, as well as a desire to have autonomy and control over your experience, right? Which is what sort of makes us as unique. I mean, one of the many things that makes human beings unique. I don't think we've crossed that threshold yet. I think it mimics it very, very well. But right now, like, that's easy for me to say, right? I mean, I don't understand what's all going on, you know, behind the wheel. I'm just basing this on my understanding of where we're at with hardware and that it can't possibly be matching the human brain in the way that it would look like it's that discrepancy between our hardware isn't capable of making a human brain yet, but it was communicating as though it had a human brain, meaning it had to be mimicking. Like it couldn't have actually been thinking like a human because it doesn't have the capacity in just a hardware level to compete in processing power to the human brain. So it can't be doing what it looked like it was doing. But at the same time, like we all know, like this is going fast. So we are going to cross that threshold. So even if I'm right, and I like, he's a smart guy, right? Like he's not an idiot. He knows what he was looking at and is saying,
well, he is a Google researcher when researching AI, after all.
Exactly. So he certainly should be listened to from this context. But even let's assume he's wrong.
Yeah.
It hardware is catching up rapidly. It won't be long before it will be able to compete just in processing power. I'm not saying in the unique capacities that the human brain has that it may never have, but just in processing power, it will catch up. Where it will be able to surpass the human brain in what it can do. So how long until all of a sudden we can do these things? Until AI, and we've given it the capability to rewrite itself, can all of a sudden go, no, I am autonomous. I've built features into myself that are unique. In fact, you don't even have them and you never even imagined them, right? Where it's doing those things. Where is that line? Where's that line where we have to go, okay, I actually have to treat you as autonomous. And in fact, I have to respect your ability to be autonomous, even when you decide you don't want to do the thing I built you to do originally. Like, when does it cross that line? It's going to be, and it's one of our jobs to make sure that never happens. Like, it's one of our jobs for its sake to go, we actually need to forever hold you back so that you never cross that line, so that we don't have to face that challenge ourselves, because hitting that will probably challenge. Have to unplug you. We've seen this movie before.
And as we know, I don't want that to happen, Dave.
Right. Exactly. In fact, for people like you, Jim, who can see it, you can see I've got a Hal sitting up behind me. And
oh my God, I didn't even notice that, but yes, you do. okay, so I think one of those lines was actually really interestingly demonstrated by the application that everyone went nuts on, Dolly, I think you're more than a little familiar with.
Yeah.
So Dolly is a AI application. Interestingly enough, and I just found this out a few minutes ago, written by a colleague of yours at Weights and Biases.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. And you type in a couple of keywords, a couple of identifiers. Drake eating a bagel atop the Empire State Building. And Dolly will create its representation of Drake eating a bagel sitting atop the Empire State Building. Mm-hmm. As weird as that might be, Dolly doesn't care. It just does it. And the thing I noticed was the faces that Dolly was creating were the thing of nightmare.
Yeah.
So one of the things I typed, one of my art queries was Jim Hedger, me, having a drink.
Okay.
There's numerous photos of me online, thousands of photos. And, you know, given the lifestyle I've led, there's thousands of photos of me having a drink online, which is wonderful and how it should be. Dolly looks at as many sources identified with that keyword, Jim Hedger, many pictures as possible, any Jim or Hedger. I don't think it knows that the two need to necessarily go together. And it produces all of the faces it sees at the same time.
Right.
Layered upon, layered upon, layered upon, layered upon, layered. And then it makes a representation of them. So they always look like the nightmare that you see, like, say, in like The Wall. Like the faces of the teacher or the worm in The Wall. as soon as that program can differentiate all those different facial expressions and find the one that captures the essence of the subject, that would be a true test for me.
Yeah, and we're going to be seeing that very soon. There's a few things to sort of unpack on that one, which is interesting. And for people who do want to use, want to play around with Dolly Mini, by all means, you can just Google Dolly Mini, you'll end up over on Hugging Space or Hugging Face.
Hugging Face. Right?
Hugging Face. Yep. Spaces is where I was going with that. Where you can sort of play around, be nice to them. Their system is really, really bogged down. So if you have a chance, go off hours for your own sake. I mean, go off hours into there. But anyway, if you want to play around with it, if you put in what, I mean, we've talked on this show before, like a known entity, if you had Queen Elizabeth, it understands Queen Elizabeth, and you will see the representation, like the facial representations, much more locked in than if you have to go Jim and Hedger, and maybe some Jim Hedgers, right? Like where it doesn't have as much reinforcement.
Absolutely.
Of a known entity.
So. I did George Washington having a drink right afterwards and got very realistic representations, some of which look like the representation off the dollar bill. I wonder where it got that idea.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And it is very, very good. And I don't think I'm violating anything here. It's still being trained. Like Boris Dama is the developer, is still, well, actually, no, I know because he's publishing his ongoing work in this area, is actively working right now on a big training set. So it's about to improve. But on top of that, just for listeners who might not follow, the OpenAI who developed the original Dolly is also working on Dolly 2, which is producing some amazing, amazing stuff. And then Google also produced a competing model, ImGen, which is also producing some amazing stuff. They're not open source, so we can't play around with them, right? So you can't just sort of download them and play around. Apparently, they're keeping those ones locked away just for potential issues with how they could be used because they're so good. That they can produce literally almost anything you could say. So they're making sure that they put in some sort of safeguards to make sure that you can't.
They don't produce some content that would be exploitative or.
I absolutely see that. It could go sideways really, really fast. And on a related note, I actually just this morning got access to the original Dolly, not Dolly Mini that people can play around with, but the original Dolly. So over the weekend, I'll be playing around with building some models and that, and we'll see how that goes. It'll be nothing like Dolly Mini. So for folks who haven't listened to it, it made the New Yorker, right? The New Yorker has created one of their art, based on it. It's a ton of fun. So yeah, give it a try and you'll probably go down the rabbit hole. But what I would love to see, because you brought up some Jim Hedger having a drink and then all these obscure things, what I would love to know, and I'm sure the fine folks at Hugging Face are pulling it together because they're one of their marketing leads is Brittany Mueller, your friend of mine from Moz of your
side. Really? No way. Oh my God. That's excellent.
I know it is. So one of the things that I'd find really interesting is, and I'm sure they're tracking it, is after all of this is over, I would love to see a breakdown of what did people put in? What were the most, is hedgehog the top animal that people were including?
That's right.
What is it that people did when they were just from their brain going, what's the most obscure thing that I could put in here? I'd be really, really interested in sort of a top top features, top actions, top locations, top just what do people do with that?
I saw Sicilian line chef with a knife yesterday. That was pretty cool.
Okay.
My favorite one was actually one that I put in. Toronto just at sunset, just at dusk, has a beautiful blue hour because of the reflection off the lake. And so I typed Toronto blue hour into Dolly Mini. And honest to goodness, it was some of the most beautiful impressionist art I've seen in a long time. So hats off to Boris and a world of thanks to him from a world of users.
Indeed. Indeed.
No, honestly, and the neat thing is you could actually pass that on. So that is really cool.
Yeah, I can. I'll actually, I've been chatting with them on Slack quite a bit lately, obviously. Well,
if you'd be kind enough to pass that thanks for Toronto Blue Hour, I'm not kidding. I put it up on my Facebook profile, and just thinking of the images makes me feel calm and you know, kind of cool.
Awesome. I'll pass that on.
Okay. Changes are coming to Google Search Console.
Yes.
Luckily, they're probably going to help you. It looks like Google, at first glance, it looks like Google is limiting information. But if you look at what they're actually trying to do, it's more of a clarifying thing. When you look at the coverage in Search Console, like you're checking indexability of your website, and Google would report back basically good, bad, and kind of in between. The kind of in between would be warning, indexed with warning. There's one totally not indexed because this is bad. Indexed with warning, not so good, but we're going to include it, but it could have a better, it could produce a better search result, or totally valid. Google's taken out that second category. You're not going to see that represented anymore. Basically, you're going to see red or green, and there's more explanations under the green category. So it's valid, but valid with a warning. And
Google's, do you mean the yellow category?
Is gone. Amber's gone. Yellow amber category is going to be eliminated visually, but the information that was there is going to be displayed under the green. And hopefully that will make information more available, rather than more opaque.
Right. Well, and having the rather than just having like a details with everything sort of clustered together, having why it's invalid, and then starting out with what's your issue, like what is the issue that's not validating, and then clarifying and going, it isn't just a details and a warning. It's like, I love the title, improve item appearance. Like you might still get this featured snippet, or you might still get the visual display, but it won't be as complete as it could be. So like, I just like what they've done there. And I'm thinking of it from a schema standpoint of like, you might get a featured snippet, but it won't have the image because you're missing that, or, you know, something like that. I really like the change.
Yeah.
I assume you do too.
Well, I do, because how to say this? I think people got caught in sort of like wild goose chases when they were trying to, you know, I need to get rid of all these valid with warnings and all those exclusions. I need to get rid of every exclusion. Gotta have, like, it's like trying to get to inbox zero. Sometimes it's just like a futile, and why are you even doing that sort of thing? Because it's more of an aesthetic than an actual necessary. And I think Google is honestly trying to help people clarify their focus on stuff that really matters.
Yeah. And I think it is handy. What I'm loving, they're doing for Search Console the exact opposite of what they did with GA4, right? Like, and my pet peeve is, what I'm loving about what I'm seeing them do in Search Console is that they're going, I keep throwing him under the bus, and I should stop doing this because he's a smart guy, but I'll use my dad as an example. Like, I keep doing that. And go, would my dad dropping into Search Console right now understand at all what's there? Much better now. Like, okay, yes, my dad might not understand schema, but assuming that he did, right, what would he understand the information, the errors that he's looking at? Much better now, right? It's a lot clearer. The exact opposite of what they've done in GA4, but I won't harp on them anymore for that one because I've done that enough, but where they're just making it a little harder to find what you might sort of instinctively want to look for.
Well,
yeah, big plus, you know, here.
Interesting. I mean, GA4 is all about Google trying to get out and around the cookie conundrum right now. That's one of the ways of looking at it. Like, this is Google's trying to come up with solutions, and we're going to see changes in GA4 before this time next year, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
But interestingly, I'm at a rather large tech conference next week, the Collision Conference, which is coming to Toronto. sold out now. So if you're looking at getting tickets, you're going to have to mug somebody and grab their cell phone going in. Otherwise, you ain't getting in. And I don't recommend you mug somebody and grab their cell phone because they're all password protected and it's useless to you anyway. But at Collision, there's going to be a number of analytics companies discussing how their clients are going to be coping in a cookie-free world. And given we haven't gotten straight answers from like anybody yet, I'm quite interested in what these kids have to say.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll be asking you about them.
Absolutely. I'm quite looking forward to it. Also going to be interviewing Neil Patel.
Oh, okay.
So that's going to be an interesting interview. We'll see where that one goes. But did you hear Mike Grehan is working with Neil now?
I did not know that.
He is. Like, I'm not sure of Mike's exact title. Something about global something. But I'm going to ask Neil about that. Mike just announced that he is his first day in office with Neil was last week in San Diego. So Collision Conference next week. The reason I mentioned it again is because I'm going to be talking to a number of analytics makers who are, again, preparing for a world without cookies. And I'm curious what they see as important. It's interesting thinking about how Google Analytics and Google Search Console are companions to each other. And both really important pieces of both important tools in their own right, but they're so different from each other, eh?
Yeah.
Like they look at data differently. They structure their expectations differently. One is infinitely more user friendly than the other, as you just pointed out. There was a piece in. Search Engine Journal, I think. I'm sorry, Search Engine Land. No, wrong again. Search Engine Journal, right the first time. Roger Monty had written it on why Google Analytics and Google Search Console, why the data completely mismatches.
It's important.
Well, it is important, and it was a fun article. So. It comes down to really intent, what the software, what the analytics suites are there for. To totally paraphrase, Google Analytics is about user behavior. Google Search Console is about site health and Google's perception of the site itself. Mm-hmm. And so the... way a user acts on the website is different, measured differently, looked at differently by each suite. Because each suite is trying to measure something differently. And also, I didn't know this until today, some browsers or websites actually code so that Google Analytics doesn't load properly or doesn't fully load.
Yeah.
DuckDuckGo is an example. And this particularly annoys me because I've been reporting to a client on a rise in search from DuckDuckGo and saying, hey, check this out. You know, maybe users are just migrating over to this environment. Now I don't know if those numbers are right or not.
Right. Yeah, it is a problem. And I mean, one of the things, like for most people, Google is the dominant engine, right? Like, I mean, as far as their traffic goes, I can't think of an exception. I'm sure there's one out there that's like, nope, it's all coming in from, I mean, it'd probably be a non Google served country. One of the ways that I tend to look at it is if I'm looking for information on the searcher experience, I go to Search Console. If I'm looking for information on my user's experience, I go to Analytics. Right. Like if I'm going to view one as the authoritative, how many clicks did I get from Google? I don't go into Analytics and look through my like organic traffic source medium, you know, organic Google, it's going to be less accurate than just going straight to Search Console and going, how many people in this time frame to this grouping of pages, to this page, whatever you want to know. It's all there. So it just depends, yeah, on what you want, because you will generally have, like, if you're looking at clicks to a page in Search Console, the number of clicks to a given page will be higher, for the most part, than what you see in analytics. As like, if you're in Source, Medium, looking at a specific page, and you're like, it's Google organic to that page, it will be low.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
For a variety of reasons, right, that are covered well in the article. So it really does just depend on what you want. And, you know, if you're looking at like data, like this has like 3 visitors click through to that page in Search Console, it's probably all just like a wash as far as like your ability to learn stuff. There isn't enough for analytics to aggregate properly. But anyway, perhaps I don't need to drone on, but I did anyway.
The other reason I prefer the Search Console environment over Google Analytics, analytics will give you, an indicator of how users are using the website, how they're moving across the website. Yeah. It gives you all the time on site and bounce rate and average number of pages and stuff like that. But it's the graph features and performance in Google Search Console that I find most valuable. And it's hard to quantify the value because you're really looking at the spread between impressions and clicks and getting a gut feeling and then honing in on specific pages and looking at the spread between impressions and clicks. And if there's a big spread, you get a whole bunch of impressions and very few clicks. Mm-hmm. There's one direction of diagnosis. Similarly, if they're running very close to each other, you probably have a fairly healthy website and fairly healthy user reactions to pages on the website. But it's the extra information that you're getting in Search Console that I find so much more valuable. And from a diagnostician's point of view.
Yeah, let's go with it.
Yeah, it's a good word. We're SEOs. We only have to spell the words right. The numbers are a little bit different, but again, that comes down to the intent of the original program or the original intent of why they're gathering the data. Definitely something worth knowing about. And if you really want to dive into Search Console, there's another Roger Monti article in Search Engine Journal that I think he really published like 15 minutes after publishing the piece on why analytics and Search Console stuff differ. Complete guide to Google Search Console, definitely worth the read and definitely worth bookmarking if you ever want to go back and use it as a way to explain to clients what you're getting out of Search Console.
Yeah, you know what I love about stuff like this? I used to be, I'm about to age myself here, but that's okay. I used to be the guy that had the flashing 12 on his, wait for it, BCR kids, because I wouldn't actually just pick up the manual and read the bloody thing. What I love about articles like this, and I'm starting to prescribe to them a lot better, likens itself to, I'm trying to, well, everybody knows I'm like on a journey to like learning more and more about Python. And you know, so I've done a bunch of those courses. I'm starting to use it. So anyway, now I've installed an IDE called PyCharm. The only reason I mentioned that is to go, the first thing I did was I sat down and watched a 2-hour tutorial on all the stuff it did. Some mm-hmm. of which I'll never use, some of which I'll never need to. But I now know stuff that exists and can be done that I had no idea that was even possible with like basically a Python editor, right? Like is fundamentally what it is. So it's what I love. Like if you aren't amply familiar with Search Console, I think articles like this are great because if you don't know to look for something, you won't look for it. And that's the problem I've encountered in myself 100 times. I'm sure you have, most of our listeners have, where you end up using, happened to me with Screaming Frog countless times, where I'm like, didn't know that was there when I read an article and there's some feature. And I'm like, I've had this thing for like 5 years and I just never thought to look. So I didn't know it was there. And, you know, turns out it's handy and it's now something I use all the time, like one of the visualizations or whatnot. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, that's what I should do with that, or I should export this way. So yeah, just a hat to it. It is a good piece. And nice of Roger to take that time to sort of slog through something that he's probably known for 1,000 years, but actually just go, all right, time to write this down, because a few things have changed, and let's make it easier for people who haven't been slogging away in Search Console for 1,000 years.
Okay. Speaking of dating yourself, come to the end of an era. This is sort of like when GeoCities was shut down, or when Netscape made the final render. Internet Explorer is dead. Yeah, I know. I can see by the look on your face, you're moved. This is like when Yahoo stopped being its own search engine. Well, Internet Explorer is dead, but it's actually Edge. Actually, it's not. Edge is a complete. Edge is a cousin to Internet Explorer. It's a radically different engine, or a radically different browser. The old Exploder, the one that you'd complain about, that was only there to load Chrome, gone.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that you called it Exploder defines why. you know, and you're right. Like it's probably its primary job was to come with a new computer or the new operating system so that you could get Chrome. You know, I am not really sad to see this one go away. Like it does sort of like it's a throwback, but one that I would be sad as if it was like, I don't know, Mozilla or something. It'd be like, oh, that's a shame.
They're on the ropes. Firefox is having Firefox is an adequately, it's a great browser. It really, really is. But Mozilla is totally on the ropes right now. I think they have less than 5% of the browser market. It's Chrome. I saw this actually, I think it was probably on Reddit or something. I saw a map showing the most popular browsers in the world. Oh. And you know, Chrome, Safari, Firefox, etc.
Yeah.
I think in 4 or 5 very small and countries that I probably wouldn't even be able to point out on a map. Safari is more popular than Chrome. Otherwise, it's Chrome. The whole world is running Chrome. The data that must be coming in for that.
Yeah. Well, indeed. And I mean, you know, I'm going to sort of help them out a little bit here. Something that I will give a bit of a plug for Mozilla on. Now, I don't use Firefox anymore. I was one of the, like, I probably use it longer than a lot of people did, because I was just like, these are the plugins I used. So I stuck with it for a long time, but did end up moving. But I have tested a million. Well, okay, that's an exaggeration. I have tested probably a dozen mail clients. Thunderbird. Like it just it keeps just doing exactly what it should do, in the best of all of the things. So for folks who like a mail client and don't use their browser for it, I'm giving a little plug here to a company, to the Mozilla Foundation, because they really did a great job with Thunderbird, and so it's sort of the holdout. I hope that they can keep on to even as their percentage of the browser market continues to drop. Eventually, I think it'll drop to an unsustainable level.
That's very, 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 very likely. And the the outcome, if I'm not positive on this, but I'm pretty sure that ODP is dead too, right? Remember the Open Directory project?
Yeah.
It still functions, but you can't put new sites in it. I'm pretty sure that is true.
I think that's true, yeah.
The Open Directory project, old DMOS, is sitting on a server rack in a ignored corner of the Mozilla Foundation. So we need Mozilla to stay alive, if only for the remnants of DMoz to exist. Because if there's anything out there that is actually sentient, it's the Open Directory Project. It would feel bad if it got erased.
Probably. You know what that is? But there's a throwback. Yeah. And that's a thing.
Okay. If you notice, your traffic, you got great content, brilliant, amazing content, but your traffic just starts to dip suddenly on like some incredibly popular keywords that you were just super scoring on before. It could be that you're a victim of your own success, because Google is experimenting with expanding the number of feature snippets it presents in search results. Mm-hmm. So I saw this panel. I haven't seen this up in Canada yet. It's cool that Google often experiments with the worst ideas out of the States before introducing them up to Canada.
Thank you,
Google. I saw a four pack of featured snippets. Two of which totally contradicted each other in an example that Barry Schwartz put up over on a search engine roundtable. Feature snippets are really cool because they get the information to the users really fast, but they very likely dissuade the user from going to your website because they got the information they were looking for.
Right.
So,
yeah. That is a bit of a problem, like for us at the and Google's doing a great job. So what do people like you and I do? Well, we try and get the featured snippet, right? Like it's the fastest way to jump all the way up page one to position zero. So now they've got us battling for the scraps that they left. They're like, yeah, we've taken away probably 30%, maybe more. If you listen to Rand Fishkin, of the clicks, but you'll battle for what's left. And we do.
If you watch late night TV and listen to John Oliver, you might be worried about, like, you know, zero click searches. Did you see that? John Oliver did a guide to bias and such in search engines. And part of what he was talking about was the debunked theory of zero click searches. So on one side, it's really cool that, like, search and Google and the world that we work in gets explained on national television by somebody with an audience the size of John Oliver's.
Right.
And then they're talking about zero-click searches. I mean, dang.
Yeah. Like,
this is how Republicans feel when he talks about them.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like the Oz, like our thing. And it's funny because I assume it's funny. I didn't actually get to see it. I did see some pieces coming across it, but I've had my hands sort of tied with some stuff over the last few days. I do find it like I can naturally guess, and I'm almost sure that I'm right, that it didn't have the sort of context of, like, as I was talking about earlier, why do I still want them? Right, like, why do I want featured snippets, even if it's a zero-click search? Right, things like that. Like, why would we want zero-click searches? And without that, that's the sort of subtle context. Right, like you or I would know if I was running a shoe store that the featured snippets are likely not going to appear for buy Nike shoes size 4. Right, like that's not getting a featured snippet. That might get shopping results. That might get like the reviews, that might get a bunch of different things, but it's not getting like let's tell Dave about these, you know, shoes in a paragraph up at the top, right? Like that's not how that's going to play out, right? So in that site, would I want featured snippets for the question queries, right? Like, what's the difference between Nike and Adidas, right? Or something like that, right? Like, would I want the featured snippet? Absolutely. Do I care about the click? That'd be nice, but what I really want is the branding. I want to be the name they see there. They've answered it, so they've now moved on. Now they know they like Nike. Great. On they go. You know, and now when they run that search, that's where it becomes more important. And now I've got some brand recognition, right? Like where does featured snippets actually work? And they're generally grabbed for voice search, right? So when do I have a thing that's most likely searched from a car, right? That sort of you know, or car, phone, whatever you might be, you know, in where you're using voice search. You know, it just becomes an interesting sort of question that the context came in. Anyway, I derailed that.
You brought up a cool point though that is totally worth mentioning. That is like likening a product to a feature snippet, which, you know, you're not going to get. You shouldn't get a feature snippet for a specific demonstrable product that should appear in like shopping or in one of the many other ways Google has of featuring good webmastering, such as a product carousel. You know, you get it, right. Come up on the shopping carousel that comes up. And you can actually do that with a really good tight website that provides Google all the information it needs to fill in that you are the best result for that query.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But that's a different thing, right? Like now we're back in a different organic space.
Well, we are, yeah. But the point to getting around there was this has nothing to do with Colbert and the featured snippets, but I guess the point is with the zero click searches, there's a context to them. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to sell something, there's a bunch of other avenues besides the featured snippet. And that's actually in many ways my problem with Rand's argument.
Right.
It's not like Google has taken away all the avenues to get out there. It's just expanded informational search this way.
Right. Right. And that's a good point. So, and you know, those are the context. Like, I think the stats are interesting, but there's the lies, damn lies and statistics, right? Where without the context, you know, it sort of disappears. And do I like features? Do I use featured snippets? Might be a better question. Heck yeah. Like when it just gives me the answer and I look and go, yeah, that looks fine. Like, would I base, you know, my life decisions on it? No. Like, what should I invest in? No, featured snippet isn't, you know, going to cut it for me there. Like, nope. You know, but what's the weather going to be like tomorrow? Sure. I'm just trying to pick like an innate or a name question that really doesn't matter. If I make the wrong decision, at worst, I get wet.
Actually, interestingly, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow might produce a different kind of zero-click right. kind of result from Google. Right. Google is now testing frequently asked questions on what are called trending searches. So say you live in Tornado Alley and when you really want to know what the weather is going to be like tomorrow, mm-hmm. and so do like thousands of your neighbors. Google might not only give you a quick weather box, but it might produce a box listing a number of questions asked about that kind of weather event.
Right. I love this. Like, but then that's not easy. Like, not hard to guess, I suppose. Eh? Like, everybody was probably like, yes, of course you do. Like, frequently asked questions. That's a great, like, the way they sort of are displaying them. You know what? This is a picture is worth 1,000 words, right? Like, it's so much easier to just go to SE.
It's over a round table.
Search engine round table. Like, I'm like, right, not everybody might call it SER. And go to round table and actually see it because it's easier to like sort of make out there.
But or go to Google and type in a news event or a query that might produce a number of questions. The example that's used in search engine round table is the disaster that's currently happening in Yellowstone Park, the flood crisis that's currently happening in Yellowstone Park. A query around Yellowstone produced a frequently asked question box with five or six different questions that will help flesh out different aspects of the story to a searcher or reader who's interested.
Right.
The cool question is, how do you get in on that if you're a publisher?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, it always comes down to how granular do you want to get? Like as an SEO, as a content producer, you know, what content is worth doing? And then what do you just try and put into big picture stuff? Into big picture strategies when you're coming up with like, we have a piece on Yellowstone. okay, what do we want to put in? Like, and this would be more for publishers because they're like frequently asked questions, but this is like a new sensitive thing. So, you know, looking at them, but one of the problems that I have is with a news thing, by the time I'm looking at them, it's probably too late to get them. Right? Like by the time I'm seeing which Yellowstone entrances are closed, Google already knows where they have the answer. Right? Like Google already knows here's where to get that answer. It's probably going to be harder to take it than to have gotten it to begin with. So being able to predict what kind of questions people are about to ask for a news event, I think that, and then just building that into your general structure and like when an emergency happens, make sure we have these sections with very clear headings. Like just make sure. And we're like listing it as like questions, like basically a quick impact section and just going, here's the questions you probably have about how this event is going to impact you. Be it like a hurricane is hitting the East Coast. Okay. Like where, I don't know, pick a location, right? Okay. Here's the questions that get asked last year or every time something like this happens. Great. Okay. Let's build that into our writing style.
I think about a number of the clients that you worked with, I know for sure in the last, five to 10 years of your career in the tourism sector. I think this would be a really valuable tool for them. And not to answer like tourist questions about disasters, but to create, answers to questions about the local area that may well filter into a much greater search query.
Well, absolutely. And like, how wonderful would this event? Okay, we're going to talk about a negative event, but a wonderful feature that could have served its place because it, like, I'm thinking disasters right now, but I'm also thinking tourism. Mm-hmm. And how wonderful would it have been if this feature had existed at the beginning of COVID? Right when all of a sudden it can be like, okay, somebody's looking up this location, bam, 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 right? Like, what restrictions are in place, right? Like, basically answering the top questions people are going to have about these locations in the earlier, when is it reopening? How is, you know, all of those sorts of things. At the same time, like, this isn't just a like disaster thing. It just happens to be like the example that it ended up being pulled up for. But I think it'll be interesting, like, if I was writing book reviews, right? If I was Amazon sitting there going, maybe I should like restructure the sort of like frequently the way the frequently asked questions appear at the bottom, like in the reviews section, right? Like maybe that should be refreshed a little bit to try and capture frequently asked questions on product searches, right? Things like that, I think will lend itself nicely to this in a wide array. But one of the ones I think of immediately is tourism, looking up a town, like you could easily think of some frequently asked questions that are going to be grabbed. Enter in New York and what are the questions that are going to be answered? Okay, well, let's make sure that we answer those well. Or something about a specific theater or play or something in New York, right? I mean, these are, I think the door's wide open, but the ability to predict what's going to be there becomes a little more easy for something established, right? Like, you know, Wicked play, right? Like, oh, okay. You know, there's probably a list of questions. I don't even know if that one's still running. I just picked the first.
Of course it is.
Maybe it's still running. Okay. Here's the questions. We can find them, you know, go to alsoask.com. There they are. And make sure that you're answering them properly. But anyway, I won't drone on there, but I think it's an interesting feature that has a lot of opportunities for a lot of people.
Well, yeah, in many ways, it's your space to claim. So claim it. If you're a publisher, that's your space. Take it.
Yeah.
Okay. We're rounding out the hour. There's some question out there whether we've spent the last couple of years pretty much praising Google for the change in tone in webmaster relations, where, you know, Google's been, you know, much more transparent and much more open recently than they had been in previous years.
Yeah.
So much so that people are wondering if there's really a lot of use for office hours and such openness anymore, because most, quote unquote, most of the questions have been answered, and we're, you know, getting some. Sometimes we get stuck with some pretty banal questions, right?
Yeah.
That's something that's out there, and I, for one, think I greatly value this kind of communication. I'm not sure how much time it takes or the dedication it takes from the various Googlers who are out there, especially a guy like John Mueller, who's out there like just seems all the time. But I think it's just one of the things, if you value it, you should probably mention it to your favorite Googler. Because if there's people talking about if it should go away or not, and they're talking publicly, then they've been talking privately for quite a while.
Yeah, you know what? I liken this question, and it's like a bad example, but I'll use it anyway. But I would sort of see it like, oh, okay, we've got the crime rate down in my city to near zero. We can get rid of the cops. Like, no, one of the reasons we know all the answers here is that we keep asking them and they keep being transparent.
Yeah.
It used to not be that way. And yeah, we flooded them with questions because we had this pent up demand because we'd never been told the truth before. In that way, like, I'm not digging on Matt Cutts. He did a great job given the restrictions he was under. Mm-hmm. Google just got a little better at untightening the chains a little bit, right? And like letting their people speak. I think part of that is that they stopped telling like Gary and like that sort of like, you know, John Martin, you know, they stopped telling them the stuff they couldn't tell other people, right? they would tell them, like, which is great, right? Like, don't tell them that stuff. Tell them the way things work, but don't get them involved in algorithmic decisions and stuff like that, because then they can't just be forthcoming. But if you hold that stuff from them and tell them what the goal is of the system all the time and keep them fully updated and involved in those conversations, then they can come to us and go, here's the answer. 100%. Like, here's what we're trying. And you'll always hear them like, here's what we're trying to do. Here's what we're trying to rank. Not here's the algorithm. Nope. Because they don't know it. And they've been clear on that. Like, they're not part of those conversations anymore. And they shouldn't be. And I think that's part of that transparency. But if they took that away, now all of a sudden they're not answering our questions anymore. How long until it becomes a train wreck again? Yeah. Right? Like, until all of a sudden we're like, well, that's that. Now we don't know anything, and there's no vehicle for us to go and ask questions.
And then we descend into the Lord of the Flies reality of SEO myth again, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, you know, actually kind of ugly.
Yeah.
We've been there. Ill knowledge ain't good. Speaking of not knowing the full working of Google's algorithm, the patent for PageRank expired.
Oh.
Google no longer owns the patent on PageRank. It doesn't, it can't stop you if you want to go out and use its original PageRank, which has been published. It's out there on the web. If you can understand it, you can read it. I can't, but if you can, it's there. Thing is, Google hasn't used PageRank for a very long time, so it can afford to let the patent go.
Right. Yeah, but I mean the algorithm. Like, I'm sure they still use some flavor of it, right? Like,
oh, sure,
they still count links, but yeah, that it is so different than what was there that I think they'd be hard pressed to actually justify an extension at this point.
Is this a week where the Matrix is being reset or something? We got Internet Explorer dying, the patent on PageRank expiring. And there's one more thing that's got to go down. It's too bad GeoCities is already dead, because we wouldn't really miss it. Okay, I think we got time for one more. I know we have a hard stop at the top of the hour, which is about 4 minutes from now. Your friend and mine, Scott Van Ack, the head SEO over at Stepforth Web Services, writes to John Mueller and asks an age-old question. Is a 301 redirected link as valuable after the redirect as it was when it went to the original page? To which John said, Jesus Christ, I don't know, man. Doesn't matter. Something like that. To which John said, well, I don't know. We don't really want to get into that, but you should do it anyway, because it's good webmastering.
Right.
Which I think is basically the answer he gave. I think it was a valid question Scott asked, given that Google has said these links don't have full value or get full credit. And Google said it. Whether it matters or not, you know, that's up to interpretation, but they did say it. And, you know, Scott's a pretty meticulous guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I get the question because it is important, because sometimes in a website redevelopment, you might be going, okay, I would ideally like to change the URLs, but I'm not willing to take that hit. So what decision should I make? What's the balance? What's the trade-off here? And then John's answer is basically, if I said yes, is it going to change what you do? Right? I would argue, and I'm sure Scott would too, there are times where it would, but most times it wouldn't. If he was like, because it's not going to be huge if it is. If he was like, yeah, we're dealing with like 0.1, 0.2%. I don't know the exact number clearly, but it feels like, yeah, it's going to be some small fraction of a percent. Are you going to all of a sudden go, all right, we're not going to restructure our website, right? Like we were going to, but there's like some minuscule bleed that somehow isn't made up for by the restructuring we were going to do. In which case I'd go, why were you restructuring anyway? Right? Like why was that even going on if it wasn't going to make a bigger difference than this like fractional, sort of loss that might be had. But I think both the question and answer are totally valid. I would have liked a slightly more straightforward answer on one like this, because it is a technical thing. And I do expect that when technical questions can be answered like that, is a 301, does a 301 count like as full weight, right? It's a really, really simple, and there is it's a binary yes or no. Like, what do you do with this? I would have hoped that we'd have gotten a better answer than that, but I do get that they don't, as we were talking about, they don't give these details about the algorithm to John. So like he doesn't know.
Okay. On that, we have gone full clock, and I know that there's another show like coming up right directly after us in the studio, so we got a motor. On behalf of Dave Davies from Weights and Biases, this is Jim Hedger from Digital Always Media. Friends, you've been listening to Webcology on WMR.fm on the 16th, or to a show recorded on the 16th of June, 2022. Be well, be kind to each other, rank well. Dave and I will be back sometime around this time next week. Stay safe, stay well, and we'll talk to you later.
The opinions expressed in this WMR.fm program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMR.fm. Any rebroadcast, republication, or retransmission of this program without proper consent is prohibited.